know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM, KUCI. In Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this January 28th, 2009 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. I am Marie Stone. I'm your host. And as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. This morning, I'm joined by Amy McKinnon with her debut novel, Tethered. And coming up in our second half hour, Jinsy Willette will be here talking about novels, short stories, and writing in general. Amy McKinnon's essays have appeared in the Christian Science Monitor, Boston Globe, Seattle Times, Huffington Post, and on NPR. Her debut novel, Tethered, has been described by the New York Times as a hypnotic debut. There's a quiet, almost stealthy quality in the writing. Clara is an astonishing character, and with language as blunt as the death she sees every day, she expresses herself with devastating simplicity. Published by Shea Earhart Books, it's out there now and available for you. Amy, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. Before we start, I have to echo what's been said about this novel more than once, and that's the amazing amount of detail, of graphic detail, you're able to render onto the page. You intimately describe the life of this mortician, a life I'm frankly fascinated by and wanted all the gory nitty-gritty, but then when I got it, some of the passages got to me. So I'll recommend that people not eat this or not read this while they're eating, which is what I did a time or two. So anyway, I'll let you introduce the book and tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the book is about an undertaker, Clara Marsh, who doesn't believe in God. She is disconnected from living people, connects only to the dead. And she does that through the burial process. She buries each one with a flower she chooses from her own garden. Each flower has a meaning. For instance, for the man who beats his wife, she chose marigolds because they represent cruelty and love. Mm. Or for a child, shasta daisies because they represent innocence.
Mm. Nice. Tell me about the origin of the idea, because it's got an interesting one. I think it's got roots in your own family of where you came up with the idea for the mortician and for the character.
Right. My uncle is a funeral director in Whitman, Massachusetts. And each year we would go to his house for Christmas dinner. And I suppose it never really occurred to me that we celebrated the holiday one floor above the dead until the year he invited us to see the renovations to his funeral parlor. So we all went down there, and it is a beautiful old Tudor, and it was indeed gorgeous. But when I asked, where do you prepare the bodies, that's when everybody else left, and he took me down to the basement, to this room. And as much as I described it in the book, it is pretty much a concrete bunker with fluorescent lighting, and it smells of formaldehyde, and it has floor drains. And it was pretty startling.
Yeah.
<Be fair>.
Indeed.
But I'm naturally curious. And my uncle is a man of great faith, and I am not. And so when I noticed that he had a painting of Jesus overlooking the stainless steel work table, I said, could you do this job if you didn't believe in God? And he said, I don't see how.
Yeah.
And that started the story working for me. And I always had the first line and the last line, but I had no idea what came in between.
Did you always know it was a mystery, or did it start out as more of a character study?
I don't know that it is a mystery. Some people have painted it as such, but yeah. I think true mystery readers would be disappointed. It's really more about one woman's search for faith in herself and in other people and possibly a higher power. The inclusion of any sort of mystery element at all came about when I heard a story on NPR about in 2005 about a little girl whose body had been found in 2001, and she remained unclaimed and unidentified. The community christened her Precious Doe, and the NPR story in 2005 was to announce that they knew her identity. Mm. And it astonished me that a child could go unidentified for so long and nobody would know who she was or care. Mm. So I adopted her for my story because I wanted to give her a happier ending than the one she had in real life. Mm. And the book is dedicated to the true Precious Doe.
I love that. And tell us the story about Clara Marsh and how she came to you, because there's a fascinating story that you have on your website that we'll talk about later, but a fascinating story about how her name came to you and how she sort of emerged into your consciousness.
Yes. Well, as I said, I'm not a person of faith, and when I tell people this story, they say, how can you not be? But the first chapter of this book took me 6 months to write. And part of that, if you read the story, you see that I don't announce Clara's name until we're some way into it, and that's because I had no idea what her name was. Mm. She is a very damaged character, and she would tell me her story only in bits and pieces. And one day my husband and I went out for a drive, and I saw an antique shop in our neighborhood that I'd never seen before and have not seen since. Mm. And I said, let's stop there. We pulled in, we got out, and I said, oh, my goodness, I have the character's name. It's Clara Marsh. And my husband said, okay, well, whatever, as husbands do. And we went inside, and not 2 minutes later, I looked down on an antique table, and leaning against a candelabra was an envelope with a 1-cent stamp addressed to Clara Marsh.
That's weird.
Isn't that...
That's really weird.
Isn't that pretty amazing? So I bought it, and I promised myself if this book ever got published, I would frame it and hang it above my desk.
I'm
looking at it right now.
That is amazing.
It is amazing. And there were lots of those signs along the way while writing this book.
Yeah, I always wait for those come to God moments. And, you know, I think in the writing, maybe they come to you. You know, maybe Jeffrey Eugenides had a bunch of these happen when he was writing Middlesex. And
yeah.
I think they talk about, you know, if you sit around and wait for the muse to come, it's never going to show up. But if you come and, you know, sit at her feet every day, maybe you get a few clues now and then. So that's...
Absolutely.
That's amazing. That's amazing. The other thing that struck me is kind of, so you're a mother of three and you're mentally living in this world of, you know, really damaged people, abused children, the rest of it. I don't want to give too much of the storyline away, but, and I'm wondering if it has any impact on you mentally to sort of live in this world for a period of years while writing the book. Is it psychologically difficult to hold that in your head while living your non-writing life?
To hold that in my head, well, I think the problem is that writers, I think any writer while working on a book, lives pretty much wholly in the world of the book that they're working on.
Yeah.
And reality is difficult to connect to. I'm fortunate in that I do have three young children, and they force me back to the real world. But I was not affected by the story because I always knew what the ending would be.
Mm, interesting.
And I knew that the ending would be uplifting, and I could hold on to that. In fact, I know a lot of writers write out of sequence, but I forced myself to wait until I got to that part so that I could write through the difficult passages.
Interesting. And the ending never changed for you. What started the ending remained the ending.
It was always the ending, especially that last line.
I like that. I'm curious about character development and the process of excavating characters for you. I was thinking about that Michelangelo quote about, you know, when he was looking at the marble that eventually became David, and he said, well, I just chipped away everything that wasn't him.
Right.
And I was wondering if that sort of plays a role in your process. If you know, if it's as important to know as much about what a character isn't and chip that away as who she is, or does she kind of come to you, I'm thinking of Clara, but I guess all of the characters, do they kind of come to you fully formed and fleshed out, or do they flesh out over time on the page?
Linus, who is the funeral director in the story, he was always the most easy character, easygoing character, I guess. He was incredibly verbose. I had to cut a lot of him out of the story. he's a great storyteller, and he gave me probably too much. I know, I'm talking about these characters as if they're real. I probably sound crazy, but to me, they are.
They are, yeah.
Yeah. The character of Mike Sullivan, the Brockton detective, he again is a damaged person, and it was very difficult to pull his story out of him. I always knew who he was, though. But Clara was probably the most difficult. Once we got through that first chapter, however, the story just tumbled out. And the three chapters of her backstory, those were probably the easiest to write. They didn't take more than a few hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting. The other thing that's interesting to me about Clara that strikes me as hard to work with sometimes is that at times she emerges as an unreliable narrator, right?
Yeah.
So we don't know if she's trusting herself. We don't know if we should trust her. And I'm wondering if that is hard to work with when we're not, if it's hard to work with as a writer.
I think it's easier to work with as a writer because it's more honest. I think people in general are unreliable narrators about their own lives, where our own perspectives about ourselves and others are always colored.
Mm-hmm.
So wherein lies the truth? So I think to have a reliable narrator would be a lot more difficult.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Amy McKinnon. Her debut novel is Tethered. And I want to give you a chance to read to us so that any listeners who aren't familiar with the book can become familiar with it and we can kind of step into the world a little deeper. Can you read to us?
Certainly. I'll start on page one. I plunge my thumb between the folds of the incision, then hook my forefinger deep into her neck. Unlike most of the bloodlines, which offer perfunctory resistance, The carotid artery doesn't surrender itself willingly. Tethered between the heart and head, the sinewy tube is often weighted with years of plaque, thickening its resolve to stay, more so now that rigor mortis has settled deep within the old woman. Each time I tug on that vessel, I think of my mother. I imagine other daughters reminded of their dead parents whenever they hear the refrain from an old song or feel the heft of a treasured bedtime story resting on their own child's nightstand. My trigger is the transformation of a battered corpse back to someone familiar. I was too young when she died to remember her scent, and I have no memory of her voice. But her wake, like the accident, plays in my head like a movie reel, some frames taut and crisp, others brittle, fluttery things. Though always her face is clear, before, after, and then after again at the funeral. I remember my grandmother's friends clustered near the Easter lilies, whispering their doubts about my mother's eternal salvation. My grandmother, her frayed black slip hanging just beyond the hem of her dress, bringing me to kneel on road-burned knees before the casket, "Don't look," and then hurrying me along, leaving me alone in the family room. I remember holding fast to my doll, a gift from one of my mother's many boyfriends. He said he chose her because she resembled me. Even then I knew better. The doll was elegant and slight, with porcelain cheeks and delicate lashes, lips like my mother's, and eyes that clicked shut when I laid her beside me at night. She wore a red flamenco dress, gold earrings I once tried to pierce through my own lobes, and a parchment calling card tied to her wrist, her name in curvy script, Patrice. But what I remember best of all from that day was Mr. Mulry, the undertaker.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
That was Amy McKinnon reading from her novel, Tethered. I assume a lot of research went into the making of this book, and I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about your research process and how it informed the book. I assume you sat through a chunk of autopsies and things like that to write it.
Oh. Well, my background in journalism, I love research, and I think a lot of writers use it to procrastinate. But I actually didn't do that much research. As I said, my uncle is a funeral director, and what I would do is go to his house and sit with him and listen to his stories. I never actually observed a body preparation.
Wow.
I didn't think it would be respectful to the dead or my uncle to ask. And I, in any other research I did, the Brockton Police Department helped me a lot. The Marshfield Police Department helped me quite a bit as well.
Yeah, I was wondering if the police and police procedural aspects of the research were more or less difficult than the funeral and mortuary parts of the book.
Well, none of it was difficult. I have two brothers who are cops, so that made it real easy.
You have a ready-made family for this book.
I do. I do.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, I grew up hearing these stories, and they may sound dark to other people, but to me, that's my normal.
Yeah, I love that. I really liked the flowers you mentioned at the beginning of the show is the undercurrent theme and how the flowers came to represent the bodies and the lives of the people that had passed away. Was that there from the beginning, that kind of the flowers as an undercurrent ribbon through the book?
Well, initially, Clara was burying each body with a white candle, but that got pretty boring after the second body. So I needed something more meaningful, and flowers are always associated with funerals. So
yeah,
that seemed the perfect vehicle to show what Clara thinks of these people and to show her connection to them.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun to research.
Yeah. I was wondering if you had a horticulture background, because there was a lot of research on the flowers. It was, and a really nice counterpoint to all the death, you know, her being surrounded by living things, and that was all. That
right.
Was all nice.
And it was fun to show the difference between the funeral prep room and Clara's own greenhouse, because they're set up similarly with the lighting and with the floor drains.
Yeah.
They mean very different things.
Yeah, exactly. Nicely done. I'm also, I know we're not categorizing this as a mystery, and I don't think of it that way necessarily either, but there is a, there is an art to disseminating information to the reader, so that, you know, at the end we're not surprised by a perpetrator, but we're also, you know, not tipped off too early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious how you go about that process. If it's outline, if it's organic, if it's a lot of massaging after the story is down on the page, how you decide when and how to disseminate information and when and how to manage the mysterious aspect of it, or the perpetrator aspect of it.
Well, I've been doing a lot of book clubs lately. I love book clubs. It's really the best part of getting published. but half the people say they knew right away who the perpetrator was, and others say that they didn't know until the end. But it was always my intention that people would know right away
uh-huh.
who it was.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that was because the person who does commit horrible crimes against children is someone known to the family. And it's just that we choose not to believe that it's true, but our gut tells us it is. So always I wanted that known. However, in terms of outlining, I don't outline. I just go where the story takes me. But I did always know who the person would be.
Yeah. I'm the perfect reader of mysteries because I still watch Scooby-Doo mysteries and can't figure out who the who the guy is at the end. So.
Good.
Yeah. I'm your perfect audience.
Excellent. Well, I think that each reader brings their own experiences to each book, and everybody gets something different from it. That's why it's so subjective, right?
Or lack thereof experiences, yeah. I was also drawn in by your comment at the beginning where you said you took some of this from an NPR story. And I'm wondering, with all of the news and our obsession with crime and, you know, just yesterday, you know, two horrible stories about children popped up in the news. And with this saturation, I'm wondering if that makes it more or less difficult to write novels like this. Is it increasingly difficult to be original on the page when you're competing with this barrage of reality?
Well, I don't think that there is such a thing as an original story. Hopefully each writer tells it in a more interesting way or an individual way, but I don't intend to compete with reality. But I was inspired by a news story, and I am a news junkie. I read 4 newspapers a day, and it is horrifying what we see there. So what I tried to do was to write a happier ending
to what
we see in reality, because life can be so wrenching, and I think as a novelist, I'm narcissistic enough to believe that I'm omnipotent and can change that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like the notion of reading. Being a news junkie and reading the papers obsessively, because I think a lot can come from that. Obviously, a lot of that must seep into your subconscious. And do you think you subconsciously absorb a lot of that, or do you mine a lot of material from your own life for character development and whatnot, or how do ideas present themselves to you through one medium or another, more or less?
I don't know where they come from. I think it's the totality of it all. I believe each writer takes their life experience and their observations. I think that most writers are keen observers of other people. We tend to be outsiders. I don't socialize a lot. I prefer to sit alone and watch people
mm-hmm.
rather than be among them.
Mm-hmm.
And also certainly the news does. It's the whole psychology of people that I think most writers are trying to get at.
It's fascinating, these people. Yeah.
I think that's why reality TV is so huge.
Yeah, I think you're, yeah, yeah. People are a lot stranger in reality than they are in fiction.
Absolutely.
I'm also curious about just your personal life of writing with children. You know, this show is largely geared towards writers and writers who do a lot of, you know, a lot of things. And managing 3 kids and managing the work, obviously not on the side, but at the forefront.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a challenge? Do kids make you drill in, you know, and use your time wisely, or
I don't think I would have ever written a book if I hadn't had children. I write from my greatest fears, and my children inspire my greatest fears.
Yeah,
and also they do force us to manage our time better. When I was writing this book, I was also working from home. So three kids, a job, I'd have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and write for a couple of hours.
Yikes.
That was the only way to get it done. But now that the book has sold and has sold in 9 foreign countries, I can write full-time. And my children will always be the priority. So I do work around their schedules.
That's amazing. That's a little... I also wanted to mention your website because it's a great website. You've got a lot of stuff on there, but you also have some chats that you do, a blog that you do with 4 other writers where I don't know if it's you who pose the questions or other people pose questions to you.
Other people pose questions to us. That was a writers group blog. We also have another blog that I'm doing with a dear friend, Lynn Griffin. She has a novel coming out in April from St. Martin's called Life Without Summer. Our blog is the Lit Maze, and we choose books that we love that we share with book groups because, again, we love book groups, and our own experiences in the publishing world.
That's great. I encourage listeners to check out. It's Amy McKinnon, MACKINNON.com. And I assume, are there links to all of these blogs on your website?
Yes, there are.
Yeah, it's an amazing resource. And I want to give you time to close to just give some advice to writers out there that you've gleaned either through the publishing process or the writing process.
Well, I have to say I was working, hoping to get a novel published for years. I listened to your show a lot, which helped significantly, helped lift my spirits. I also read Publishers Marketplace faithfully. But I think the most important advice that I could give aspiring authors is to never give in, to persevere. Amanda Eyre Ward once said to me, the writers she knew who were published were the ones who never gave up. And I held on to that for a couple of years until my own book sold. And that's what saw me through.
Yeah, that's great. And getting up at 4 a.m.
And getting up at 4 a.m.
Amy, this was a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you. This has been the dream of a lifetime.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Love your show.
Thanks. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Jinsie Ouellette will be with me for the second half hour discussing, among other things, her books, Jenny and the Jaws of Life, and The Writing Class. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Yeah, Writers on Writing, every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific time. Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org. And this show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit the iTunes public radio page or Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for more details on that. Of course, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, or want to chat about this show or other shows I've done, you can email me at Marie, M-A-R-R-I-E, Stone, at gmail.com. For comments about the show in general, you can contact Barbara at penonfire@earthlink.net, and you can always check us out at penonfire.com. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm here now with Jinsy Ouellette. Jinsy is the author of a short story collection, Jenny and the Jaws of Life, and the novel's winner of the National Book Award and the Writing Class. David Sedaris said of Jenny and the Jaws of Life, "It's just the funniest collection of stories I've ever read. I'm prepared to wear a sandwich board for this book. I can't help myself." Jenny and the Jaws of Life is published by Picador, was originally released in 1987 and again in 2002. The Writing Class is published by St. Martin's Press and came out last year. Jinsy, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. As I was thinking about this interview and reading and rereading your work, I realized what I really wanted was to have sort of a philosophical discussion about writing and about what I kind of think of as the alchemy of your work. So maybe we can use examples from the work to kind of fuel a general discussion about short stories versus the work of novels and craft in general.
Okay, good.
I'm curious if you think of yourself in terms of short story writer or novelist, or if it's even necessary to break things down into genres and categories like that?
Well, yeah, I think there's a huge difference between a short story and a novel, and I think I'm better at short stories than at novels, and I'm prouder of my short story, at least some of them, than I am of my novels. But short stories are hard.
Yeah.
And the hardest thing about them is, to me, the inception of them, the idea of them. They're just so dense, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a completely different fictional enterprise. I think they're wonderful. I mean, I think the short story form is a wonderful form. It's the, you know, fictional sort of the closest to poetry that you get in fiction generally.
Yeah, it was funny. I can't remember who said it, but they were talking about, you know, the writer starts off writing poetry and figures out that's, you know, too hard and moves on to the short story and figures out that's very difficult and then goes on to the novel.
Right. Exactly.
It is true.
You go on to the novel so that you can actually make some money.
Right.
And that's the truth.
Yeah.
You know?
Unfortunately, that is the truth. Yeah. I was trying to put my finger as I was reading your short story collection again on kind of the definition of a short story, because the work of it is, you're right, it's so much different than the work of novels, and the area of concern is so much different. And, you know, I suppose they're short and I suppose they're stories, but that really doesn't encapsulate what the definition of what a short story is trying to do.
Well, it's a story. I mean, I think in a short story, you see somebody at the only, in a sense, the only moment of their life that's worth exploring, or the big thing that happens to them. A short story is about something that happens to somebody. And a novel is different. I mean, basically that's it. It's about something that happens to someone or something that fails to happen to somebody.
Yeah.
It's about a change that someone undergoes or a change they step back from. And that's what it is.
It strikes me that the characterization or the way that you approach character in a short story versus a novel has to be obviously so much different. You know, you have to draw this person out within paragraphs instead of within chapters. Do you approach your characters, I assume you do, completely differently from one genre to the other?
I guess it's been so long since I've written short fiction that I don't remember. I just remember I had a lot of fun. Well, if you can say that you actually have fun ever writing fiction, I had fun trying in my own mind to transgress the boundaries. Like, you're not supposed to be able to create a whole world in a short story. The world is the province of the novel. So I would try to see if I could create a whole world in a short story. I would try to see if I could create a round, full character in a short story.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Whether it worked is something completely different. But no, I don't think the character work is any different in one or the other. You just don't have a lot of space to splash around in.
Right.
You can't just sit there and throw stuff up against the wall and see what sticks. It's a completely different, it's much more disciplined and focused.
Really compressed, yeah.
Yeah, very.
Yeah.
Very.
The other thing that strikes me as so different are the endings of short stories versus the ending of novels, because short stories often end on, I guess novels sometimes do as well, but on ambiguous or sort of intentionally off-kilter notes.
Mm-hmm.
It always strikes me as hard to know when you're there in a short story. Easier when you're there in a novel, but in a short story it seems like, well, it could have ended 2 pages ago or you know, maybe it could have gone on.
That's right. And in fact, when I write novels, so far anyway, I've always ended them abruptly. And my publisher says, listen, you've got to, you know, give us another chapter.
Right.
So that tells you something. I don't know what exactly. I think that you have more control of the ending in a short story. But, you know, the ironic thing is you don't want, at least I don't want, a short story ending to be ambiguous at all. What you want desperately is for your readers to see what you do, that you want to communicate fully what the whole point was. But I think you very rarely do unless you're absolutely, you know, spectacularly good.
Right, right. Yeah, in his part of what David Sedaris said in his foreword, and I think this is so true in the Jenny and the Jaws of Life, is that you excel in the moment, that split second when everything changes and there's a discomfort to this.
Mm-hmm.
He said
that's very nice. He's such a nice man. yeah, that's what we all go for, is that moment when everything changes.
And it's so hard to recognize it in your own life, and it's usually not the moment you think it, you know, it's not the big events. It's the small undermining.
No, but everybody has these. Everybody has epiphanies, and that's why those of us who like to read short stories read them, is because they're not literary constructs. They actually happen. We have these moments. It's just that then when we look back and try to capture them in our own lives, they tend to fly away, or we start to wonder about what they meant. But, you know, we have moments of realization.
Yeah.
So all that we're doing in the short story is trying to capture something that actually happens.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious about how much of this can be taught. I had the same experience that Sedaris pointed out, of wanting to pull out my pen and put little check marks all over the margins of your stories. That's so true. You know, it's, and she got it just right.
I want to do the same thing, but it's like scratching stuff out and going, oh my God, what was I thinking?
But I, you know, I was thinking when I was reading this, reading all your work, unlike other things I've read, it caused me to wonder just how much of this can be taught and what the limits are of teaching writing and teaching fiction. Technique, yes, and sentence construction, but
mm-hmm.
but human insight and psychology, how much of that can you get across to your students?
Well, I hope something. I mean, I teach workshops. I've started an online workshop, and I've taught in extensions and so on, and actually, what I'm good at as a teacher, I think, is form rather than, I don't like to fool around with sentences and beautiful metaphors. And so, I mean, I praise people for doing it and I point out cliches and all that sort of thing. But I think you can at least nudge people towards an understanding of form. I think you can get them to see that something should happen someplace that doesn't, or that, you know, that formally, you've got the substance of the story there, but you haven't got the form yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it could be done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to have, the student has to be, the writer has to be
engaged, and there probably has to be a certain sort of sympathetic relationship so that, you know, I mean, I don't think I could teach anybody to do it. I don't think any teacher could do that. But, right. Yeah, I think you can get across at least some of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I... It strikes me that you're sort of a writer's writer with the books of the writing class, or, you know, people that that are engaged in this can certainly relate probably a little bit more to
yeah
to the dynamics of this class than and one of the things that you pointed out, and I think this is really true, you've talked about the difficulty of showing characters to a reader that are perhaps boring or depressed or otherwise sort of unsavory to be around, and the balance of
right.
showing that kind of person and letting the reader feel and experience them without, you know, throwing the book down and saying, you know, I just don't want to spend time with that person.
No, that's right. And that's what I always end up doing is at least in novels, choosing as a central character somebody who's really problematic that way. They're either very opinionated and sort of obnoxious and negative and angry all the time, or they're misanthropic and depressed. But to me, people like that are interesting.
Yeah.
And, you can make those people... Frankly, I think more fun to be around than perky types, you know?
You can make them very funny.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, yes. You try anyway.
And I suppose if you populate the novel with enough people, you know, the writing class had a fairly good cast of characters.
A huge cast of characters.
Yeah, you can.
It was horrible. I mean, I'll never do that again. There were just way too many people. It's like mice, you know? They're just running all over the place. And you're trying to... Yeah, trying to make them memorable and so on.
That's right.
Hard. See, you don't have to worry about that in short fiction. There's usually just one or two people.
Right, right.
It's very cool.
Right. And if you see 13 people on the page in a short story, you're in trouble.
Yeah, you got a problem.
Now, this might seem an obvious question in some ways, but in other ways maybe less obvious, of how your writing has changed over the last two plus decades.
Well, you know, I got started late. I was 30 by the time, I think I was 29 or 30 when I wrote my first story. And I did, I think, my best short story writing when I was closing in on 40. And you don't really change that much between 40 and 62, which is what I am now. You don't, I really don't think it's changed all that. I mean, you, with any luck or lack of same, you become, I think, a bit wiser as you get older. You experience more, and that's going to seep into what you write. But I don't really think I've changed much. It's not like I have, you know, juvenilia. I can't point to something I wrote when I was young because I didn't write anything when I was young.
Yeah. There's probably something to be said for that.
Well, I think so. I'm just sort of grossed out by how many, especially lit fic writers there are who are just so young. I wonder, what in the world do you have to say? I mean, and occasionally they do. I mean, it's not that... there's some law that says you can't write a wonderful story or a wonderful book and have only lived for 25 years. But, boy, it really helps to live a lot longer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, for the material and for the depth of understanding and so on.
Right.
For the depth of your questions. I mean, I don't really understand anything, but, you know.
Yeah, I think
you realize more and more how much you don't know and what's at stake and so forth.
Right, right. I want to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Jinsy Ouellette, author of Jenny and the Jaws of Life and The Writing Class, and winner of the National Book Award. Great, great stuff. I want to give you a chance to read to us, too. Can you
Okay. Can
you read?
I'll just do very briefly from The Best of Betty, which is the story that actually gave me my career because David Sedaris liked it so much. This is one of the... one of the letters to Betty, who is a sort of malignant advice therapist, advice sort of like Ann Landers, only much more horrifying. Dear Betty, you hear from so many unfortunates with serious problems that I feel a bit ashamed to take up your time this way. I am an attractive woman of 59. My thighs are perfectly smooth, my waist unthickened. I have both my breasts and all my teeth. In fact, I'm two dress sizes smaller than I was at 18. My three grown daughters are intelligent, healthy, and independent. My husband and I are as much in love as when we first were married, despite the depth of our familiarity and the, by now, considerable conflation of our tastes, political beliefs, and preferences in music and art and, of course, memories. He still interests and pleasures me. Miraculously, our sexual life remains joyous, inventive, and mutually fulfilling. I continue to adore the challenge and variety of my career as an ethnic dance therapist. We have never had to worry about money. Our country home is lovely and very old and solidly set down in a place of incomparable, ever-shifting beauty. Our many friends, old and new, are delightful people, amusing and wise, and every one of them honorable and a source of strength to us. And yet, with all of this and more, I am frequently very sad and cannot rid myself of a growing, formless, yet very real sense of devastating loss, no less hideous for its utter irrationality. Forgive me, but does this make any sense to you, Niobe? Dear Niobe, certainly you're lying about the sex.
I have to say that I have written that letter out and emailed it to many of my friends already. It makes me laugh.
I kind of like that. I think Betty, that's just such a cheap shot about the sex. The reason I do sort of like that is because I like the character of Niobe.
Yeah.
Seems impossible, but in fact it is possible for a person to be both sort of a colossal jerk and aware that you're a colossal jerk. To me, that's just so interesting.
Yeah.
About people. People are great.
You know, the interesting thing to me about all of these stories, and perhaps this is not an admission I should make on the air or out loud to anybody, is that I was able to see myself in so many of these stories, even the ones that I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I could see myself in. And I was also wondering if that's sort of the difference between short stories and the difference between novels now and then, is that novels are, it immerses you in a world, but it immerses you in somebody else's world. And short stories, often I have the experience of it holding up a mirror and saying, you know, this is perhaps a part of yourself that you don't want to admit, but a part of yourself nonetheless.
That's interesting, and I've never thought of it before, but I think that probably does make sense because short story writer generally is working very, very close to the bone.
Yeah.
Because you have to if you're going to get at the whatever it is you're trying to get at, which is usually something you can't even put into words except through the story. So yeah, I think the closer you get to your own bone, the more you mine yourself, the more the writer mines himself for material, the more universal it's likely to be.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Is that part of your experience that you tend to mine your life?
Oh, always. I always use me. I never use anybody, but you know, you can take yourself and make yourself into a million different characters. It's that's easy enough to do. I never use or rarely use autobiographical details because you can't do that without dragging in your friends and loved ones, and that to me is just immoral.
Right.
But you can use your own character and the experiences you've had generally, the emotional and intellectual experiences you've had, they're totally free. You can use them any way you want without betraying anybody. And that's what you know the most, or at least, you know, if you're an analytical person, and I think most writers are, that's your material. So why not use it?
Right, right. One of the stories that I particularly had that experience with was The Haunting of the Lingards. And the thing that strikes me so great about all of your work in general and this story in particular is that you take something so benign and so innocuous and so kind of underneath the carpet, and it becomes the symbol of something so much greater. And I'm curious about that story, where if it started with the characters, if it started with the problem, if it's how these things come.
It's interesting. I will tell you, this is the only thing I've ever written. I wrote that story for my husband. He was undergoing chemotherapy at the time. He was a scientist. And I just wanted to write something for him that would divert him and make him happy. And I knew that idea would please him. I think it had its origin in a small argument we had many years before, which did not obviously blow up into a, you know, marriage-destroying thing, but talking about horoscopes and the scientific method and everything. And so I just revisited that. I wondered, like a lot of short stories, for me it was an exploration. I started thinking, I wonder if you could have two wonderfully compatible, happy people and just completely destroy them over a point of contention that's essentially intellectual, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or I wonder if that would be possible. And I think I think at least theoretically it would be.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, in the way that poets, I guess, sometimes wrote poems for people, I wrote that story for a person. And that's the only time I've ever done that. And I'm very fond of it because it worked, you know.
Yeah.
He really liked it. And I really like it. And yet people don't talk about it much. So I'm glad that you were interested in it.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting question, don't you?
It is. It is.
You know, would it be? And in a way, I feel like I kind of cheated because I paint them as this wonderfully compatible, loving couple. And yet, you know, if you really think about it, maybe the whole premise is wrong. Maybe they wouldn't have been attracted to each other. But I don't know.
No, I think there are couples that certainly project something that not only to the outside world, but to each other. That is perhaps a great untruth, and they can live their life for years like that. That's what I found so interesting.
Yeah, and then you open the wrong door, and everything completely falls apart.
Exactly.
And it's very sad.
Yeah.
I've never actually known of a case where that happened, but I'm sure it has because it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the other story that jumped out at me, well, so many, but as I'm flipping through here, so many. But Under the Bed, I've never gone through an experience like that. It's about a rape. But it's amazing how you're right, how as close to the bone as you get, the more universal the emotions get. And the real tragedy, as you point out, of what was lost. And just astounding stuff. Just astounding stuff.
I'll tell you something funny about that story. I found out by accident between when this collection was originally published in 87 and when David Sedaris, you know, gave me the boost, when I was just not read by anybody and had been completely forgotten, and that was fine because I had other things to do, I found out by accident that Under the Bed had been included in an anthology, a writing anthology of essays, of nonfiction. And I picked it up and read it, and it was one of these things that had, at the end of it, there were questions for the student. You know, it was one of these books that is a textbook.
Yeah, yeah.
And the questions, how does Willett deal with her rape? And I thought, what? Just wait a minute, you know. Her attitude towards her rape, you know, I've got, wait a minute. And I finally, for a while, I thought it was funny, and then I just got kind of annoyed because I thought, well, you know, they could have written to me. I mean, you know, and found out that this is fiction, for crying out loud. How naive can you be? But anyway, I thought it was funny.
It's so interesting to have your work published without them letting you know about it, too.
Yeah, like yeah, it was. You know, no money changed hands or anything. It was very, very interesting.
Very nice, yeah. you have said that you aren't one of those writers that revise. So you get something down and it's down and it's done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I assume that that's a lot of internal work before the words go onto the page.
Yeah.
Do you think of stories or novels or things as fully realized as they kind of pop out of the, what's that mythological?
No. I mean, the only thing that I know how it starts and I know generally where I'm going, or I think I know where I'm going, but I have no idea how I'm going to get there. If I knew how I was going to get there, I wouldn't bother because it would be boring, you know?
Yeah.
It's the great middle, the terrifying middle. Whether it's a short story or a novel, they have that in common. The middle is what makes or breaks you. And I would never outline, I would never even think through, well, A has to happen and then B and then C, because that would just completely take away from the impulse to tell the story. And also, I mean, what would be the point of writing if you knew how you were going to get there?
Right.
No.
Right. Yeah. Just so many great things. I'm curious why you turned away. If you feel the intensity and best work comes out of the short story, how you decided to turn to the novel?
I just ran out of short stories. I mean, frankly, there aren't very many, and. I mean, I wrote a few years ago, I wrote one very, very short one for McSweeney's, but basically, that was it. Mm-hmm. And most of those stories were actually written in a very short period of time, during a time of great anxiety for me. I mean, my husband was ill, and I was frightened, and anxiety is a fantastically energizing, creative thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing like it. I mean, at least for me, and I imagine that's true. If you can turn around and catch the thing that's chasing you and pin it down. It's just a wealth of material, especially for the short story writer.
Yeah.
But after that's all over with, the impulse goes away. I haven't thought. It's just not there. You know, I have nothing to say. In short fish, I'd be delighted, I guess, if tomorrow I suddenly thought of an idea, but that's just gone. And that's okay. I mean, I don't see any reason why we have to keep writing. Don't you feel that a lot of people just write too much?
Oh, yeah.
'Cause I do.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, why didn't you stop there?
Right.
So I don't count novels among that, because the novels to me are diversions.
Right.
But I wouldn't just write. And in fact, in that collection, the story about the serial killer sort of signaled to me that, well, I'm done. You know, this is just getting silly. This is a bit forced. Maybe I should quit now. And so I did.
That's hilarious. We're unfortunately drawing down on the clock, but I was hoping you could leave the writers out there with teaching advice, writing advice, publishing advice, whatever springs to mind.
Don't worry about publishing. Just worry about writing and getting down on paper exactly what it is that you want to get down. It's strictly what you're doing is you're communicating. You're trying to take what's in your head and put it in somebody else's. So focus on that. Don't worry about agents. Don't worry about publication. Just write as well as you can.
Yeah, great advice. I also wanted to mention your website, which has a wealth of great things, a lot of humor and a wealth of great things, which is Jincy Willett, JincyWillett.com. And there's information on workshops and a great blog and just a lot of great stuff. So I really appreciate you taking the time this morning. This was fun.
This was fun for me, too. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That was Jincy Willett. Her books, Jenny and the Jaws of Life, winner of the National Book Award, and The Writing Class, all available now in bookstores and online. We lost another great writer yesterday, John Updike, to his battle with lung cancer. So I'll close on a few Updike quotes. Creativity is merely a plus name for regular activity. Any activity becomes creative when the doer cares about doing it right or better. And a second one from him, what art offers is space, a certain breathing room for the spirit. As my husband said last night, the rabbit is finally at rest. That's all the time we have for today. I'll be back here again with you next week, Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. when I'm joined by Lauren Groff and Temple Graydon. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day. Most of all, I just don't wanna be free.